Hello there. Joining me today on Burning Books is author Brendan McEvely, whose debut novel, Deep Burn, is out now with Marrowbone Books. I started by asking him what kind of a reader he was when he was a little boy.
Yeah, as a kid, it was kind of brush your teeth, wash your hands and face, and then we'll have a story kind of thing. And so there's five kids in my family, but me and my brother were the last two, me being the youngest, and we were quite close together. So we shared a bunk bed in a small room, and we were really tight. Before that, we had a little double bed, so me and my brother slept together, and then we got the bunk bed. And I would still go up to his bed or he'd come down to mine. So we shared a single bed. It was really nice. Now, he was also an awful brute of an older brother at times, but mostly we got on. And we would sit either side of my mom, backs against the radiator. And she would kind of began with read-it-yourself books, which were actually kind of mostly from the 70s. So they were hand-me-downs from my sister, who's kind of 15, 16 years my senior, and then two other brothers, Connor and Barry. So we got all these books like The Sly Fox and The Little Red Hen and Chicken Licken, mostly where one group of animals kills another group of animals. Someone gets their comeuppance, or someone is tricked into death or being eaten or being thrown in a pot or something like that. But the best of them was The Magic Stone, or as we called it, Soup Made from a Stone. And it's kind of like a famous book in our family. And I'm now reading it to my five-year-old recently. Weirdly, we're back in my mom's house for a little while. And so she's in the same bedroom and she's got a bunk bed.
Oh my gosh.
The top bunk is called Teddy World and all the teddies are there. But I'm kind of reading all these stories to her and she's kind of like shocked and appalled and excited by them as much as we were. But The Magic Stone was basically a tramp meets an old lady in a forest. He's looking for a place to stay. He kind of talks his way into coming back to her house and then says like, "Oh, I'm starving." And she said, "Oh, by the way, I don't have any food. I'm a poor woman and I can't help you there. You've got to be on your way if you're looking for a bite to eat," kind of thing. But as he arrives, he sees there's a cow in the garden and there's vegetables planted all over the place and kind of gets a sense that she has more than she's letting on. So he tells her he's going to make her soup from a stone. He throws this stone into a pot of water and he's cooking and boiling it up and saying, "Okay, it tastes great, but you know what? It would be just that bit better if we had an onion or two." And she's like, "Oh, I have an onion in the garden, I think. Let me race out." And bit by bit, he's like, "Well, it's getting really good now, but if we just had a bit of beef or a few carrots or a bit of milk or whatever, cream." And so she ends up putting everything into the pot. And the final scene is kind of, or one of the final scenes is the kitchen table with the soup, but like a roast ham and all the extras, bread and vegetables. And so she's like, "Oh, what an amazing guy. Thank you so much." He gives her the stone as a parting gift. She lets him sleep in her bed while she sleeps downstairs on the chair. And the final scene is him wandering off the next day and her realizing she's been had. And she has thrown the stone and it's about 2 inches from the back of his head. It's about to crack his skull open. So it's this beautiful scene of like revenge and comeuppance. And I feel like so many stories of that era are kind of a bit brutal.
Yeah, a bit mischievous, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
And so then the next kind of step up was suitably Roald Dahl, who is equally kind of malevolent. Or there are mischievous, to say the least, characters in his books. And Nora, again, my daughter, is like, "We're going through Charlie and the Chocolate Factory," which is maybe, it's not as bad as George's Marvelous Medicine, which is truly awful. And very like full of hatred for various different groups. Lots of women. He hates women.
Yeah, the witches, you haven't, yeah, yeah, you haven't got to the witches yet, have you?
But Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is actually on Spotify, so we have that anytime we're in the car now. That's kind of just on repeat.
When you're reading to your daughter, then, if you're reading to Nora, is it awakening, like old memories, or are there like old kind of sensory things coming back to you?
100%, yeah, yeah. And it's just so strange that we're in the same bedroom as well. So it's like,
are you actually using the same physical book?
Yes.
No way.
With Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, no, but with,
okay, with the magic stone.
Yes. And all those other read it yourselves. So we've kind of, they've been around the various siblings as they've had kids, and they're back in the house now with us. So.
And I wonder, will other books, like as you get older, will they still translate to her? Because I know with my kids, when I tried to do it, not with the early books, but with later books, you know, like The Secret Garden and all of those kind of things, just didn't land the same, you know, because I think with or even just the kind of narrative with the older stories, I think there's just something kind of almost eternal about those stories. Mm-hmm. So it's quite simple and go right to the heart of things. But like later on, it's like, what kind of books were you reading, like, I suppose, into primary school and beyond? What did you get your hands on when you were reading yourself?
Yeah, so that there is kind of a gap then between, I suppose, kind of like 5, 6, 7 and 15, 16.
Right.
Where I feel like books were still pushed in front of me a bit. Like at home, I remember getting one Christmas Kidnapped by Robert Louis Stevenson. Or maybe an abridged version of it. It's like a hardback kids version, and being deeply uninterested
in this adventure
that I had just opened. And it was maybe computer games, like that would have been around the time we were also getting a NES and Nintendo.
Yeah.
And in school, there was like a kind of we would get catalogs of kids' books, and you could pick books that you could buy kind of on the cheap through the school. So I remember reading like Dick Hinksmith, who was, yeah, a kids' author. Yeah, reading, I was still reading, but not like, it wasn't deeply important to me. And
yeah.
I don't have a book from that period that I truly loved or like returned to over and over. And then,
sorry to interrupt you. Where was your imagination going around that time? So it was computer games.
Yeah,
it was like
computer games. Yeah. And then I think it kind of blurs into the beginning of puberty. And I was truly lost to puberty and friends and girls and being out and hanging around and spending as much time with friends as possible, and books just being not there at all. I have a really strong memory of, I suppose I would have been 13, 14, on holidays in Kerry with my cousins, and we would have, like, every summer would rent a kind of a bungalow bliss style holiday cottage in Kerry, actually where the book Deep Burn is set, as it happens. Again, bedrooms kind of filled with bunk beds. And I remember wandering in, one of my cousins, he's like 2 or 3 years older than me, spent all the time in his room, and he was reading Trainspotting.
Oh, wow.
I was like, oh my God, you're completely wasting your holiday. You know, what is it? I remember just having this conversation, like, what is it about this? First of all, there's a film version, so why do you need the book? And second of all, like, it's sunny outside and you're hidden away in here.
Yeah.
And I just didn't get it. And so I just kind of hadn't had that experience really with a book. And I think the first... sadly, like, my first... Or not sadly, that sounds, dismissive. But I remember my parents were away on holiday. I was sick and my nana was looking after us. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, I had been shipped into my parents' bed, and I was, because my nana was just like dying to mother me, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
She just kept me in the bedroom and was bringing up and down tea and toast the whole time. And I was absolutely bored out of my mind. And it was the summer holidays as well, so I was dying to get out. So I was just like, for want of anything to do, I grabbed a book from my mom's bedside table, and it was Body of Evidence by Cornwell.
Oh, Patricia Cornwell. I remember hearing through series of her as a teenager. Yeah, like a detective thing.
Yeah, exactly. And so was like, this is, first of all, it's very thick. And I was like, oh, wouldn't this be very mature of me to like get through a book? And I, it was maybe my first experience in a long time of like not putting something down, you know,
right.
like reading and then, or, you know, having lunch and then picking it up straight away again. I think there's a brief sex scene in it.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Book has this. And obviously, I suppose, like, by that stage, I would have been reading, like, I remember we did How Many Miles to Babylon for the Genius.
Oh, yeah,
so that would have
yeah.
been around the same time. So I would have still been forced to read books, but not in a way that, you know, I sat there for hours wanting to get into it. And
yeah.
maybe that was the first. And then I remember picking up A Portrait of an Artist, which my brother had done for his junior cert, and it was just kind of knocking around the house. I kind of started again to just like look around the house to see what's going on.
I just have to stop me there because I'm just the juxtaposition of all of these books is actually hilarious. But so like Patricia Cornwell and followed by Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, literally side by side. Oh my God. And then before that, Jennifer Johnson, which you weren't really getting into, she did this definitely some sort of like interesting thesis on those three books. It must have like lodged in there somehow. But like, do you sort of wish that it hadn't been Patricia Cornwell, that it had been like, you know, The Unbearable Lightness of Being or something? You could say, well, yeah, the book that brought me to reading was actually The Body
Bound. Well, you know, mostly when I have this conversation, I think I do say Portrait of an Artist, but just because I was, you know, I knew we had this conversation, I was really digging deep and I was like, oh,
yeah,
man, that was the one. That was it.
Much more interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so
sorry, yeah, I threw you off there. So
yeah,
you were looking around for
I don't know. I guess by the time I picked up Portrait of an Artist, maybe something had switched on inside me again.
When you picked up Portrait of an Artist, so you're about like what, 15, 16, something like that?
Maybe,
16.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you get it? Yeah, just tell me what was your experience of it? Well, like honestly.
Yeah, I think there must have been so much I didn't get at 17 or just going 18.
Yeah.
And thinking about what to do. What am I going to do with my life, or at least in college? And I had always thought, you know, probably just almost a default switch to commerce, and being sort of entrepreneurially minded, I've always had that kind of streak of setting things up and starting.
Uh-huh.
And I always thought, oh, probably that. But then thinking, oh, English or literature, or maybe I could try that. And philosophy, I remember reading the prospectus for philosophy and it's like, oh, this sounds curious. And
for a second there, I thought you meant the prospectus was some kind of philosophical novel I had never heard of.
just the like two or three paragraphs that tried to sell you this as a way to spend your next 3 years, but I bought into it. And so I did English, philosophy and economics together.
Wow.
At UCD. And then once I had started, I kind of realized, okay, this is the way, this is the way I'm going to go with my life, if you like.
I can see how, and we'll come to the book deep burning in it, but I can see how all of that kind of feeds into this novel, actually, very easily. Once you were at UCD with these three kind of different strands, when did you feel a sort of a tug towards making something?
I think maybe even before, during my leaving cert kind of 2 years, we had to write essays and short stories and things like that for the leaving cert itself. And I remember handing one in and the teacher, English teacher, coming back a short story saying, like, kind of pulling me aside and saying, you know, this is good. This is like, there's something here, you know, this is publishable. And I don't think it was. It would have only been like 700 or 800 words. So, but he saw something in it that was, let's say, above and beyond the rest of what was being handed in. And I thought, oh, wow, this is something I'm good at. And I'd had an experience of that actually before in class when there was a short story writing competition and I came joint first. I split the pound prize. So I got, me and Graham Seagrave got 50p each for our short stories. So maybe that would kind of reinforce this sense of, okay, English is my strongest subject. And having read Portrait of an Artist, there may be something here. This may be a possibility. Not knowing quite what it was that I would actually do. And maybe journalism and maybe teaching as well or something like that. But I think I had a sense around that point that I'd like to try writing without really truly doing it in a meaningful way.
Yeah, just started
for years,
to,
you know what I mean?
To percolate. Yeah. I really want to ask about, what was it, Graham Seagrave? What was his name?
Graham Seagrave, yeah.
Where's he now?
Where is he now? He's not writing now.
No, he's going to say...
Last touch, alas.
Right, I was going to say, he also came joint first in sixth class.
Yeah, well, it's all ahead of him, maybe.
Okay, so far, at this point still, there's been no sort of rupture in your life or your psyche or your emotions or your heart, so you're still sort of intact at this point in life, are you?
Yeah,
I assume everyone at some point is ruptured. I don't know when it happens. Maybe you're still intact and you're still fine. Great, but most writers tend to not be. But
Do you know what? I've had a deeply happy life.
Have you?
For the most part. I always had the sense of like, is it possible that I can be a writer? And also, you know, still living with the sense of my big horror is still ahead of me.
Oh, I really hope I haven't jinxed it now. No. Like, this is shortly after this podcast.
This is the last recording.
It was the last day he was happy. That's actually really lovely to hear, though.
Maybe I'm an optimist and like bad things happen to everyone at different points.
Yeah.
Like bad things, but nothing truly awful.
God, that's a real relief, actually, to hear that, because when people are usually it's like, okay, we're going into the trauma now. Yeah.
And I have, we kind of, because Deep Burn like deals with, you know, traumatic things happen to the person over the course of the novel. And with my writing group, my, you know, friends are frequently joking that, like, you know, I don't believe in trauma, or I ignore it, or don't acknowledge it, or whatever, and that I must be suppressing something. But nothing beyond the average experience of growing up and getting knocked around and broken hearts. And
I mean, would you say it's full of trauma? I mean, it's full of lots of graphic, obviously, incidents and things like that. But
a breakup. It begins with a long-term relationship that suddenly comes to an end, and it finishes, I suppose, with the trauma in the main character's life as well. And, you know, I think there's a degree to which when she arrives, she wants to ignore things as much as possible, or suppress things, or put the old life behind her and just look forward. By the very end, when she's kind of dealing with the... final... She's still only coming to terms with, bad things have happened here, and you're not really looking them in the face.
But it's interesting the way you say now about your own life and how you view life as well, and the kind of timbre of the book, which I find really kind of really witty and smart and tongue-in-cheek at times. I mean, it's hilarious at times, but also it's sort of like it's own little hermetic world itself, even though you're kind of critiquing the sort of hermetic world of, you know, the art world. I mean it as a compliment, really, you know, that it's kind of self-referential also. We'll get to it in a wee minute, but, and again, as someone, I'm not in the art as in fine art world, but I find I could feel a lot of similarities within the kind of literary context too, you know. Sorry, we're way off. We'll come back to Deep Burn in a minute. Just back to your own reading life, Brendan, and I derailed us there by asking about broken hearts and things like that. But that's really in the context of the question about a book that reminds you perhaps of a life event, not necessarily a painful one, but if there's a book to you that was around it, like an important time for you.
I remember, I remember like coming to the end of that degree and having a sort of like a micro breakdown of just being really upset and obsessed by what I would do with the rest of my life. So it was 2005, and it was the height of the Celtic Tiger, and I was trying to decide what I might do next or what was feasible. And it was around the time that like house prices were going absolutely insane, apartment prices were going insane. And I felt there was a sense of like, also my girlfriend at the time, her dad worked in an estate agent's. And I had this part-time job where I would like cycle from UCD down into Donnybrook and do the post and do office grunt work. But having a sense that like, oh, you could slip into this and very easily, like there were 22-year-olds there who owned two or three apartments already. And you're like, oh, wow, this is, you know, you can have this if you just want to block out your you know, your notions of being an artist or pursuing your dream or whatever it is. And also then if you do pursue that dream to any degree, you won't have any of this life at all, and you'll struggle to rent a place. And things will, it'll be a long time before you might even get a job or anything stable. And so, yeah, I kind of had this sense that I knew I wanted to go in the bookish direction, let's say, to work in the world of books, but also being really scared that I would sell out, for want of a better term, that I would, it would be very easy actually just to, after a few months of unemployment, just take a job. Like a genuine sense of fear kind of built up in me. And I remember it one night peaking, and I was just like middle of the night in tears in bed, going kind of the feeling of going crazy, been pulled in either direction. That's maybe the drama. And I guess I'm glad I...
You're smiling as you're telling me about this. I cried all night long.
Still suppressing the pain.
But yeah, it's grand. I was stared into the void and it was slightly empty. Yeah. Was there something, like, what were you reading around that time?
Yeah, I guess, like, I think maybe even more than literature, philosophy.
Philosophy, okay.
Was coming to mean a lot to me. And going from also at the age of 15, being like, going to mass every Sunday and being genuinely faithful and religious, to by the age of 20, like having lost that entirely, you know. I think if you want to shake religion from your life, study philosophy, because you just go down every other possible road of what could be, if you like, metaphysically the case. And it just seemed more and more highly unlikely that what we'd been taught was an accurate representation of what is, what created and is guiding and ruling the universe. You know, it's just this notion of someone very like ourselves, quite vindictive, all powerful, watching us all the time. It just seemed more, you know, if you're kind of studying various different books every day, the story you have been told till now just seems like A, one of many other stories, and B, a kind of an unlikely version of what is actually the case. And so I remember like being quite moved by the French existentialism and Jean-Paul Sartre. And he has like, he has some big books, but there was a, there is a very slim book called Existentialism. Humanism. And just that, that sense of, it also kind of was reinforcing this notion of there is no human nature. Man is nothing else but that which he makes of himself. You choose your kind of destiny. You're kind of, you are the sum of your actions. And so it was a meaningful book, but I think it was also adding to that sense of like, you must make a choice. You must be authentic.
Yes.
You must live in good faith with your whatever desire or internal conflicts or, you know. So I guess probably at that time I was maybe a bit of a pain in the arse as well, but like, you know, romantic about it all and idealistic, and still, you know, in terms of the notion of the writing life, probably that was also overly romanticized and still leaning on that.
I mean, who would kind of embark on it without some kind of romanticism at the beginning? I mean, you just reminded me, was it Sartre who wrote Les Jeux sont faits, The Chips Are Down, or the Les Jeux sont faits? Was that Jean-Paul Sartre? Was that somebody else? I'll have to look it up afterwards. Yeah. But yeah, just what you were, that's slightly different. It was slightly more sort of fatalistic. But there was a sense, like that kind of determinism and kind of, but slightly more stoic or Buddhist in a sense, you know, it is what it is kind of a thing, as opposed to feeling kind of personal agency in your decisions. But yeah, I know that sort of stage in your 20s is kind of absolutely terrifying. Yeah. So what about, like, I often ask people this on the podcast about going back to books. I'm not one really for rereading, not since I was a child, but do you go back to books, or is there a book that you kind of...
Yeah, I suppose it's a book that I kind of came to maybe 10 odd years ago or whenever it came out, which is Long Time No See by Dermot Healy.
Oh, I haven't read it.
And I come back to that book really just because it is, of any book I've ever read, the most accurate presentation of like the human voice. I guess it's like, it's set up and around the Northwest, so you have this really accurate sense of, without anything being overdone any of the colloquialisms or anything like that. It's not hammed up in any way. It's just incredibly human, but also everyone in it, you know, all the characters are quite intelligent. And yeah, just the presentation of rural life. And it also just makes me happy, maybe, to be in that place. So sometimes you go to a book for a kind of a holiday.
Mm.
Like, you know, the Neapolitan Quartet is a book that you kind of go to for the kind of Azure blues. When in the middle of winter, when you're kind of feeling down, there's certain books where you go to travel almost, mm. or at least I do. Whereas, yeah, Dermot Healy, it's maybe as a writer looking for to like reconnect with what is truly great writing, or it's almost like the plainest, non-stylized mm-hmm. version of prose. It just seems so close to the human experience, the way people speak and the way people behave. It's deeply realistic.
So I was going to say it's so truthful, yeah.
It's kind of like, is it a touchstone sort of, if you've been reading X or Y or Z, which is like highly stylized or in a particular voice or tone,
mm.
going back to that book brings you back to ground, or back
yeah.
to who you are a bit, or how things actually are. So maybe that's just a book I return to kind of partially as a writer, partially as a human, to get grounded again. For a long number of years, it was just always on my bedside, and my wife would kind of joke, like, oh, you're reading that again. And I would pick it up when I had nothing, like, on the go, so I kind of just read it round and round in circles, and you could dip in and out. And she'd be joking about, oh, you're at that again. You need a new book, or you need a good book. And I was like, oh, I have a typer. Well, and I just, in advance of this, I was looking around, I can't find it. And it's such a nice addition as well. So I'm going to have to work out who I loaned it to.
That's nice, actually. That's on my list now. I love getting new recs. Long time no see. Yeah. Perfect. I'm going to come back to one of your own books, because I know we're going to get to Deep Burn in a second. But before mm-hmm. we get to Deep Burn, just two last questions. And I don't know if you want to answer these or not.
Oh, no.
So again, as I always say, it's mischievous rather than malicious. Mm-hmm. But a book that you would leave in your burning house, a book you would leave behind.
Yeah. Do you know, I was looking around and bought this book a couple of years ago called Dictionary of Irish Artists, and it was a big fat chunky thing, and it was in one of those like discount bookstores for like quid hardback, but I realized it was like wrapped in cellophane. I realized when I got it home and cut the cellophane off, I imagined I would be treated to like a visual display
of
the art, you know.
Yeah
It's literally just the dictionary of names, born, died, member of the RHA, member of whatever. And for hundreds and hundreds of pages. And so it's the kind of, you know, when you end up with a big fat tome that's completely useless to you, it's the question of like, can I put this in the recycling bin?
Yeah.
You know, or no one will want this. Not just I don't want this, no one could possibly want this. There's a reason it ended up in kind of the bargain basement bookshop or section. And what do I do with this? It's just like, I suppose it's insulation for the walls in your bookshelf.
Yeah.
But beyond that,
it's gone.
Very happy for
that. That can go there along
to go up in ashes. Yeah.
With the poor compiler who somebody somehow commissioned that person to put that together.
Why would that is brutal. Yeah.
And they're like, no, that you missed the. Yeah. Okay. That's gone. And then the last question is really about something that isn't a book or an animal or a person that you would save, not leave in the house. Sorry. That you would save from the house. Yes.
I was thinking again, I'm not desperately materialistic as a person,
uh-huh.
other than for books, like we were talking earlier, about just being mad about the physical quality of a good book. But the only thing I have a collection of is matchboxes. And I didn't realize this until I didn't realize I was collecting until I gathered all the matchboxes up in the house that I have. And it kind of began around, you used to get into, back before the Garda ID or like people checking, you know, you could use your brother's use it ID to get into a nightclub. When I was 15, the first club we were able to get into was called Club Mono. And it's on Wexford Street, I think. It's where the Village was and Opium Rooms now is. But it was Club Mono back then, and they had this beautiful lowercase sans serif logo of just the word Mono in white against a black background. And they made matchboxes with that. And the matches are black wood, white tip. They're just the most gorgeous thing ever. So maybe, you know, that being the first addition to the collection, I began. And then I spent some time in Berlin on and off over the years. And pubs and clubs there also do matchboxes, and supermarkets. And getting like matches in different languages is always cool. So I have this cool little like collection of matchboxes that ironically, I would say from the
fire. From the fire. Yeah. That is too perfect.
You may be too perfect.
It is perfect. It is perfect. And it, of course, leads us seamlessly on to talking about your novel, which I'm dying to talk about. Oh. And it came with a beautiful little packet of matches.
Oh, it I was so just, happy for a good excuse.
And so our listeners obviously cannot see the book, but I have to say it is just a work of art in itself. It's beautifully, beautifully produced and laid out by Marrowbone Books. And the cover, I was reading on the cover of it here, it's like, you probably know the colour palette here. Like I would say cream and red, but I'm sure they have their own Pantone colours. It's like checkered with beautiful kind of illustrated objects in each. Am I right in thinking that you're making ceramics of all the little objects on the front?
Yes. Yeah, I'm working my way through. So I've made the urn and I've made the lobster pot. The lobster pot I've made kind of as an incense burner. So
it smokes
out the top. And I've made the oil can as well. And the oil can is actually made as a pipe, so you can smoke the oil can. And then I've made three of the hand grenades. And I have kind of notions. So I went up north recently and just bought a ton of fireworks. And I'm pulling the fireworks apart and cracking them open and crushing down the innards for the flash powder or gunpowder.
Yeah.
And basically I have a beautiful a vision for what to do with the hand grenades, kind of like building holes into the top of them and then put a fuse in. So it'll kind of video in slow motion and photograph the exploding, not of the object itself, but like of the powder shooting at the top. And I kind of have them glazed in green, white and orange. And I'm going to get the flash powder to match the color of the glaze. So that it'll be kind of like a triptych of little photographs or short videos. It's just like pure indulgence. But, you know, I have this sense of Martha is a visual artist in the novel, or she's someone who becomes a visual artist. And there are other artists, fictional and real, within the novel. And I feel like maybe Martha more than anyone, but I'm trying to become and make as many of the objects. I've also like photographed fires all around the countryside, and I have plans for many more.
Like you're sort of, you're becoming Martha, but like you're mirroring so much of the book in that, and like you're responding to your own artwork and an artist in the artwork with art. It gets ever sort of like increasing circles. But can you tell our listeners a little bit, just the kind of general concept of the book, first of all?
Yeah, it's about Martha, whose relationship breaks down and she just wants to disappear. Her husband leaves her and she just wants to almost jump the gun and leave him. So immediately kind of disappears out of his and everyone else she knows life, gets on a bus, heads as far away as possible from the centre, from Dublin, and ends up in a seaside village on the Iver Peninsula in Kerry. And
with Vinny.
Comes across Vinny's house, which is as advertised as a kind of artist's studio and gallery, and she kind of knocks on the door. And very quickly they're getting on, she's moved in, she's renting a room, and he's saying, oh, you should do this, you should try this, you know, and gives her this nice camera. And the kind of the first night she's there, she has this vision for her first photograph of a swimming pool built into the beach with a fire floating on the pool. And she wants to photograph and she doesn't quite know what's burning. And that gets filled in over time. But over the course of the novel, then she kind of sets herself up as this person who, as an artist, who people come to her with objects from their lives that have some kind of emotional weight that they want to get rid of or exercise, but have to feel maybe some obligation to hold on to at the same time. And so Martha comes up with a way of burning them or exploding them in like weird and wonderful ways within the landscape. And so she replaces their objects with a photograph of the burning or of the exploding. So she replaces that object with something beautiful. And she kind of, she has doubts about herself as an artist because she's not
qualified.
And she wants to pitch it as a consultancy or a service. And also that the notion of a consultancy being a respectable career that, you know, that with a good income seems more appealing to her. But Vinny is encouraging her to like, no, this is the way you've got to pitch it. This is who you've got to sell it to get ahead.
I think it's really clever because, like, you know, in some senses, like, you kind of at the start, you kind of go, and she's like, well, what? I'm not an artist, I'm not a photographer. Like, I literally got the camera 10 days ago or something. Yeah, yeah. I think, well, how does anybody, you know, like, in some senses, how does anybody become anything in the art world? But, and then there was a really good, was it Vinny or was it Kingsley who was talking about craft and people who look at art and they're like, oh, I could paint that. And he was saying, look, people who have craft in spades who worry about it, it's about what you do with it. It's about your vision. It's about your idea.
It's like the key.
But like, sort of part of me is nodding along. Part of me is going, oh my God, this just looks so much. And it kind of ricochets like that. So there's this great conversation about like, what is art and who is an artist? And it kind of flickers and flickers throughout. I thought it was so, so beautifully executed.
Yeah. There's a great book kind of on the art world, which is Grayson Perry's Playing to the Gallery. And I feel like maybe I describe myself as being like less cynical than the novel is.
Yeah.
For kind of dramatic purposes is often cynical. He would advise be skeptical, not cynical.
Mm.
And yet I suppose we all have that experience of coming across artworks where, you know, ideally a work of art has craft and the idea and the vision and it's communicated well, but sometimes you feel that, you know, having that experience of, well, the idea is kind of weak and I could have built that or whatever it might be. And those are the worst case scenarios, and they can kind of, you know, you can just point at those and say, well, there's lots of bad art there, but there's, you know, I'm definitely aware of all the good art that's out there. And it's just, particularly in this country, there's so many.
Yes. No, we heard that caveat.
Earnestly, yeah.
I hear you on that too.
Kind of feel like, you know, the novel kind of quickly moves into a different world or a different stratosphere of not just like the Arts Council funded Irish art world, but the kind of currently collapsing, I believe, global art world. And how prices are pushed by stories and backstory and how important the kind of origin story of the work is. And often that work is really good and the artists are, you know, are just others, the right place, right time.
Yeah.
As I guys have been plucked out from amongst the millions of others practicing and are kind of pushed as the next hot commodity, basically.
Mm.
Wouldn't we all love that?
Kind of there's an absurdity to that. I mean, there really is. But like exactly that, if you happen to be the ingenue in that situation, you're going to embrace it. But like, there is that sort of question about what is bogus. You know, I think there's PhDs written on what is art. You know, I don't know.
I was just going to say, I feel like in literature or in storytelling, it doesn't take an expert, I feel, to work out when a story is bad. I think we're all experts at story.
Mm.
We all write emails. We've all been told stories in pubs or wherever. And so everyone is an expert at good and bad narrative. Whereas there are spheres within the art world that you're like, you doubt yourself, you know?
Yeah.
Wondering, am I qualified to say this is truly awful? There is a bit more uncertainty in that world, I think. And so there's greater room for bad actors.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
But I think there's so many, I can't really go into some of the things without ruining it for the readers, but there are some kind of like really great it's like photographs, but you know, the setup of the photograph, like what the thing that or that is going to be burned and the kind of visualization behind it, they're actually really great. I was looking at it going, God, I love that. I mean, I know that we're supposed to be kind of going, oh, like, but on both levels, it was like, I definitely want
them. hence, I genuinely do want to make some of those artworks as as possible. And some of them are quite absurd. Like one of them is Vinnie hopes to plant a weed forest to go out, like the city of Dublin, 10,000 plants. And another one is he draws a line between where he lives and Kerry. He paints a line on the road between Kerry and Leinster House. I don't think I'll get to that one without being arrested. But I do have notions of like maybe taking the white stripes on certain parts of road and kind of infilling artworks onto those stripes because they seem like a nice blank canvas. So kind of little odes to the work where the work itself can't be created. But just to kind of bring that world to life for me, or to keep the book and the world and the characters alive, I kind of, you know, still want to live with them for a while longer.
Can I, before I get you to, because I'm going to get you to read from the book in a little while, but just a few questions for personally I wanted to ask us. But there's a few times in the novel where I, like, you really touch on approval, which I thought was a really interesting theme for me. Maybe it wasn't a conscious theme, but approval, like there's one point where I can't remember which narrative voice, but maybe it's Martha saying to herself, you know, it feels like someone saying, good girl, well done, good girl, like a million times, you know, from your mom or your dad or
best
whatever
girl
it is.
In the world.
Yeah, it reminds me of that comedian. What was that comedian? He said, do you love me now, daddy? You know, but like that kind of thing. And then I was like, it's really interesting as, you know, as a writer, you know, people always say, write like your parents are dead, or write like, you know, dance like no one's watching, whatever. But, you know, that were you conscious of, like you say, you're in a writing group, were you conscious of your peers, you know, when you were writing? Were you conscious? Were you like, okay, because writing can be quite vulnerable sometimes. So were you conscious to maybe not be vulnerable or to keep it in a sort of, you know, anytime you get close to the bone, the irony kind of pops back in again? Or like, were you conscious of other people's eyes on it as you were writing, or did you try to just...
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I had written another novel before this for which I had got an agent, but that novel never got published. And I had spent, that was like my first go at a novel, and I had spent 5 years or more at it and worked incredibly hard at it and rewritten it and so on. And then this sense of like, oh, wow, you can spend that much time at something and no one ever lays eyes on it. And that's kind of brutal. And I was, you know, living in fear of the same thing happening again with this. Now, at least I felt I had an agent. And at coming to the end of writing that first novel, I had the idea for this. And so I had one reader ready to read it and hopefully enjoy it and send it out into the world. But I think, yeah, like I was writing about the art world, but I think there are so many parallels between, you know, what gets picked up and what doesn't, and what gets pushed and sold as the next big thing. And like I said, I do think it is easier for the audience with literature, a much more general audience, to know when they've been duped or when something's been hyped or whatever. But I guess I was, drawing on the tensions that are there in the world that I know well. But I think, it's the same in other art forms too. But yeah, I kind of, you know, one thing I've noticed, and I'm jealous of visual artists for, is that sense of you can go away and work on a series of paintings for a couple of years. And even if it doesn't get exhibited, you can have an Instagram profile. You can show people the work and they can, for want of a better word, they can consume it immediately. Whereas if I write a novel and ask, like, you know, ask a friend, oh, do you want to see what I've written? You're kind of saying, can I have 10 hours of your life so that you can read something that may be quite appalling? And then you have to lie to me and say that you thought this is great, you really enjoyed it. Yeah, yeah. It's much easier to do that when looking at a painting and finding something nice to say. I like this, you know.
Yeah, love the colors.
So I think I've kind of calmed down about, like, you know, the reception, because a successful exhibition might be 100 people at the launch, and then over the next 2 or 3 weeks, 100 to 200 other people come in and see it, and then another 50 people see it on the closing weekend, maybe, and that's good going, and you sold one or two. of the pieces, and that's kind of successful. So I think as writers, sometimes it feels like it's all or nothing. And actually, there were probably spaces in between. Or wouldn't it be great if there were more spaces in between?
Yeah,
also kind of writing the novel, wondering, you know, is it going to be good enough even for the writing group? And one truly meaningful thing that's happened in the last few months is, like, at the beginning of this year, having basically finished the book, I wrote my first short story in, feels like, 8 or 10 years. And that's being published in Winter Papers. That was still, like, I sent it to Winter Papers and Dublin Review. And I was like, oh, wow, I actually still have it. And this isn't a fluke. And the book wasn't picked up just because of this, that, or the other. Like, anytime someone tells me, oh, the novel's amazing, I'm like, I'm just thinking of the reason why they might be lying to me about why the book is good, you know? So even though, you know, I feel like I'm confident in many ways, but I feel everyone lives with that doubt of, like, am I shit, or is this worth your time? That thing of, like, can I truly recommend you give up 10 hours of your life or however long it takes you to read a book?
Well, most importantly, did you impress your wife with it?
she was the first reader, and she's a smart cookie, and she has told me of other stories like, no, this is crap. So when she said like, wow, this is good, and she was like, I was relieved that it was good. She also knows the thing of, like, what if he's going to edit this for the next 2 years and work with the agent and go through all of that.
And
I know it's terrible. So she was delighted that it was good.
Right. I'm going to ask you to read from Deep Burn now, we've contextualized it a little bit. If you need to say any more about the bit that you're reading before you read, go for it.
I might just finish in the pub. Martha and Vinny are on their way to the pub and they're celebrating. And Vinny, it's a Thursday evening, and Vinny has to bring her to the pub, because there is something on the TV.
Oh, the local.
All the town watches every week. Copyright this TV show idea.
It's great.
The local, Vinny said, was a TV show. Each week, in some small bolt hole of a pub from some far-flung corner of the country, the camera casts its lens on the habitués of a local pub. Usually 3 or 4 select characters, lushes, or militant soaks who sat rounds of breakfast pints and told endless stories. An episode begins with a question like, tell us about your childhood. And so begins a pint-long reminiscence. What followed, Vinny went on, was wild and euphoric bullshit from glory days never lived, or doubtful scientific theories delivered with a touch of bigotry. 4 or 5 hours of filming were cut down to 25 minutes, accelerating the various stages of inebriation and allowing the viewer to follow the breath and descent of emotion. The real appeal, Vinny said, in practice praise, is the artistry of the production. The montage of the first sup shot across multiple cameras. From above, so you catch the breaking wave of cream against lip. From the side, to gaze the sheer quantity of stout that flows down triple chin necks. From below, to capture the concentrated satisfaction, close enough to see the silver glint of nasal hair. The hovering boom mic catches every grisly slurp. Martha watched the sandwich-filled bread baskets circulate through the lounge, baguettes sliced into mini bites and stacked like lumber. The bar top amassed fresh pints. Unrushed, solemn men and women approached in ones and twos to retrieve glasses for their tables. Martha spotted Nina with her mother, but was too high and paranoid to approach. She just about managed a nod hello. Evelyn kept lifting glasses from the taps to the bar, and more arms reached over Martha's shoulder to take them away. No money changed hands. Vinny waited until the last moment to pluck 2 pints from the hoard. A pair of young virgins, he said, handing Martha one. Now, he spun on his stool to face the television in a cobweb corner. Someone raised the volume as the adverts came to a close. Martha watched as a miscellany of Ireland's pub fronts and interiors appeared one after another, set to sentimental fiddle music. The screen turned black, and in white curlicue font, the name of the evening's pub and parish appeared. The volume of voices in Noreen's suddenly dropped as everyone held firmly the busts of their glasses. On screen, an old woman sat down beside two older men. They were bunched together in a corner of the pub, lit from one side by late morning light that crackled through stained glass. Three full glasses stood on the circular table before them. The two men were pitched towards the woman who, it was clear, had been given the honours. The plainness of her grey house coat offset the faded tartan skirt. She wore no makeup and made no effort with her hair. She had been staring intensely at her pint, but at some signal from out of shot, the director perhaps, the old woman lifted her eyes. She gave a nod to that someone out of sight, then looked back down at her glass, reached for it, lifted it towards her lips, and took long, heartfelt gulps. Her eyelids pressed closed. Her lashes quivered with satisfaction. Martha looked around her. All in Noreen's were frozen still, awaiting some cue from the screen. It was, she learned later, the moment the base of the old woman's glass touched down on the table, at which point the entirety of the pub lifted their glasses in unison. Martha joined them out of sync, like a lapsed parishioner blessing herself. When their glasses crashed down on the tables again, the room looked around at itself, smiled, and began applauding. Within seconds, the clapping morphed into wild hoots and shrieks. I'll leave it there.
You've been listening to Brendan McEvely, whose debut novel, Deep Burn, is out now with Marrowbone Books. See you all next time.